Welcome to Sabrina Artel's Trailer Talk. I'll bring you all kinds of stories from all kinds of people. Whether it's a live public conversation and we're speaking from the kitchen table of my 1965 Beeline travel trailer, we've pieced together various conversations celebrating and advocating for the preservation of our wilderness and the importance of the beauty of the natural landscape. From the studios or on the streets, please sit back and enjoy the conversation right here this time every week. Welcome. Ooh, on a cold day, and I have Bill Streeter in the trailer with me, as well as a friend of his. Who do you have with you?
This is Mortimer. He's a saw-whet owl. Saw-whets are the third smallest owl in North America and the smallest owl in the Northeast. He weighs 3 ounces, has an 18-inch wingspan, and a very, very big head for his size.
He is a gorgeous, gorgeous bird. Mortimer, hello. How much does Mortimer weigh?
Mortimer weighs 3 ounces.
And he does look much larger
looks larger than 3 ounces, but still, it looks like he stands about 5 or 6 inches high. Very tiny. Probably one of the sweetest faces of any owl that you're ever going to see.
A very sweet face. So tell me why you had to rehabilitate Mortimer. You are a raptor rehabilitator, which means that you take birds that have been injured and attempt to rehabilitate them so they can go back into the wild, but that's not always possible.
That's correct. Mortimer was hit by a car in New York State. He was found by a man who was coming home from work at 4:30 in the morning, and he found him roadside in the snow, scooped him up, made some phone calls, eventually took him to a museum called the Museum of the Hudson Highlands in Cornwall, New York, because he remembered that they had live screech owls on exhibit at the museum. He brought Mortimer to the museum, and the museum staff called us because they're a museum, they're not rehabilitators. We came to assess Mortimer. Mortimer was in shock, so we had to treat him for shock to stabilize him, and discovered that he was blind in his left eye, and then it was a waiting game to see if indeed sometimes vision returns over time. So far it has not, so it probably won't for him. Most of our birds do go back into the wild, so Mortimer is used for education, and saw-whets are like perfect education birds.
Because of their size?
First of all, they're very gentle, they're very easy to train, and their look is just spectacular. Anybody who looks into the eyes of a saw-whet owl, I mean, it's hard not to be impressed by a little creature that looks like this.
I'm looking at his eyes, which are dark brown in the center, and then there's a bright yellow rim, and he's a beautiful brown and cream colored.
Yep.
How did you and your wife, you are the Delaware Valley Raptor Center and education and rehabilitation, yourself, Bill, and your wife, Stephanie Streeter.
Again.
How did it all begin? You're dealing with birds that are wild. They're often very dangerous and difficult to deal with, especially if they're injured. And you have to have such knowledge to be able to help them.
Well, I've always had a love of animals ever since I was a child. I was one of these kids that just explored everything, you know, grabbed salamanders and crayfish and newts and all that. And eventually went to school and majored in biology and got an advanced degree in zoology. My wife Stephanie, on the other hand, was a music major, but she was always the ultimate caregiver as a child. She would take care of injured wildlife before there were any rules and regulations when she was a little kid. And 26 years ago, when we were living in Massachusetts, we saw a man do a birds of prey program in a nature center. I had read articles about falconry the night before, just by circumstance, kismet, whatever you want to call it. And I asked him questions about falconry. He asked if I wanted to become a falconer, and I said, no, I don't have the time. And Stephanie said, yes, she would. And she became the second licensed woman falconer in Massachusetts history. This was back in 1979. So she became an apprentice falconer flying a red-tailed hawk. And then I got into it and became a falconer. And then people started bringing us injured hawks, you know, because they knew we had them.
Where were you living at the
time?
We
were living in a little town called South Athol, Massachusetts. And we had a center called this was right before we developed what was called the North Quabbin Raptor Rehabilitation Center at that time. So we ended up learning wildlife medicine from a local veterinarian plus Tufts University Veterinary School Wildlife Clinic. trained us extensively, and we had a working relationship with them. Eventually, we moved back to Pennsylvania, which is our home state, and we incorporated the Delaware Valley Raptor Center in 1987.
And so it's an educational center so that people learn more about these birds, understand them. What is the...
Education is a very, very big part of what we do. We do outreach education programs. We go into schools, and any special interest groups that wants a program, nature centers. We do anywhere from 150 to 175 live birds of prey education programs a year, which brings in about half of our operating budget. There's no federal or state money for what we do, so we have to raise it privately. And education is a big part of what we do. It's a big part of our mission. We can put maybe 50, 60 raptors back into the wild this year, and that'll certainly have an impact for the individual birds that go back. It's not going to have much of an impact on wildlife populations, but we'll educate maybe 20,000 people, 20,000 kids this year. That has the potential to be a big impact of how people treat, respect, and learn about wildlife.
Where would I see in the wild here in Sullivan County or over across the Delaware and Pennsylvania, where would I see an owl like Mortimer, or where would I see the kinds of birds that you're showing us here?
Saw-whets are a little bit less common. They're difficult to see because of, first of all, they're tiny. They're very nocturnal. You're less likely to see them at dawn or at dusk. You're going to see them well after dark. They're not birds of open country, so they're less likely to be seen flying across the road where the fields are. So we don't get many. We get saw-whets once every couple of years, although they are out there. They like cedar swamps, deciduous woods, some wetter areas as well. What we get plenty of are great horned owls, barred owls, and screech owls. And those are the three owls that you are very likely to see in the area. They're certainly a little bit more visible by their behavior, and certainly the barred owls and the great horned owls by their size.
Are they at all threatened by development, population of...
All wildlife is. Habitat destruction is the major reason why wildlife can eventually go extinct. No place to live, wildlife disappears. So there's going to be an impact whenever. But, you know, it seems to be the way of the world.
Yes, it does. What about an owl like Mortimer and the small falcon that I saw?
The American kestrel.
Eat mice.
Yes.
What about the larger birds? Is there an issue, too, of any kind of shortage of their food supply?
Actually, there's always going to be plenty of mice. I was talking to a man the other day where we had to pick up an injured red-tailed hawk, and he said, you know, there's no rabbits around anymore because of all these red tails. And that actually is not the case. First of all, red tails will eat rabbits, but they're mostly mouse hunters. Secondly, it's the availability of prey that determines the amount of predators in the area. So if you're seeing a lot of red tails, that means there's an awful lot of food out there that red tails eat. So if they were subsisting only on rabbits, and if the rabbits were gone, of course the red tails wouldn't be there.
And what about with the large owls? What else would they eat? Rabbits, mice?
Rabbits, squirrels.
Will they eat
other
cats?
Raptors, smaller raptors. A cat would be an extremely dangerous prey.
Oh, okay.
So they learn in a hurry what's easy, what's safe, what's smart. And a cat is not a smart animal to go after. It'd be you're most likely to get injured going after a cat. A kitten at night would be easy prey for a great horned owl. And I'm sure
yes.
A great horned owl has killed adult cats on occasion as well. Because pound for pound, a great horned owl is a very big and powerful bird. But most predators learn to eat specific prey, and if they see something that is uncommon, they tend to avoid it. They certainly tend to hesitate before they strike at something because they're not quite sure what this is.
What's amazing to me about an owl in the wild, I've only had the opportunity several times at my home. For a couple of years, I would spot an owl as I was pulling up at night, and just as my headlights were going off, I would see an owl in the evergreen trees, a beautiful, beautiful owl. There's something so beautiful about their stillness.
Yeah.
There is a quiet.
Whenever you see an owl, I say it's a day maker. You know, it's something that has just made your day very, very special because they're not easy to see. And yeah, there is a serenity. Not that they're serene birds, but when you see one, it's a very special feeling. First of all, it's at night, and things are usually very calm to begin with. And so there's a little bit of an excitement, but it's always mixed with a little bit of serenity as well.
You would be able to answer this for me when this is happening. It's only several times during the season, and I'll hear screeching at night. It sounds like a bird hunting, but I don't know.
If you're hearing screeching, what you're not hearing is a screech owl, okay? Because screech mm-hmm. owls don't screech. They have this very down-the-scale trill, kind of a thing like that. But it's a little bit, actually I can't do it. It's a uh-huh. down the scale whinny almost. What you probably are hearing are barred owls. Barred owls have a basic call that they do. It's supposed to sound like who cooks for you, who cooks for you all. But they also have all kinds of screeches and yells and shrieks. And it sounds like there's a disaster happening
yes,
in the woods.
Yes, it's always in the middle
yeah.
of the night.
Yeah.
And it's usually, I feel like it's springtime.
Yeah.
That it's happening.
That's when they're the noisiest.
Okay.
Because the mating season is beginning. So they're defending territories against other owls, and they're calling to, males are calling to females, females are calling back again.
Which birds would you say are you most amazed by?
I'm certainly most impressed by a golden eagle. My golden eagle died a few months ago. I had her for 20 years.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And I
20 years?
20, yeah. I've never, ever... probably experienced a relationship with a bird quite as intense as that. They're big, they're beautiful, they're impressive, they're intelligent. And so if anybody ever asks me what my favorite bird is, certainly all the eagles are special. Bald eagles are special, and I've seen some exotic eagles as well that I've been close to. But certainly my closest relationship has been with that golden of 20 years.
Could you describe that relationship? What did you share with each other? And that is a huge loss after 20 years.
It was a huge loss, and I'm still grieving for her. The good news is perhaps in a couple of weeks I'm getting another one that's been placed at our center from another wildlife rehabilitation center in Wyoming. So, and this bird needs a home, and we're the perfect home, and it's just what I'm going to really need to heal from the death of Crystal. She was 25 years old. Actually, I had her for 21 years, my 21-year relationship with her. What can you say? I guess if you were lucky enough to have, and eagles certainly aren't pets, but if, you know, most people can't relate to eagles, you don't have that experience that I've had. But say if you had a favorite pet that you've bonded with and you've shared experiences with and extend that out to 20 years, it's basically like having a member of the family. So when I go out to feed my birds every morning and look into her flight enclosure and she's not there, it's just very difficult.
These are wild birds, but you do develop a very intimate relationship. Mortimer's here
yes.
with you and comfortable, and I saw you with the birds.
And they adjust to captivity over time. You know, birds of prey aren't affectionate by nature. It's not like having a dog or anything like that. But eagles are a little bit more special to me. They're a little bit different. And I could genuinely say that there was a sincere bond between me and that particular bird. And some of the others. The red tail that I use for program chirps at me every morning when I come out to feed her. And, you know, if I hand feed her something, she'll just reach down and grab it out of, you know, from her beak. And she'll keep chirping at me until I go away. So
well,
it's pretty lucky in many ways.
Well, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Bill Streeter, let me grab one picture before
okay.
you go.
Can they hear us outside?
Yes.
And make an announcement for the... Yeah, there's going to be a Birds of Prey program very, very shortly. It's scheduled for 1 o'clock. I'm at Trailer Talk right now, and I'm going to be going over there within the minute. So if you're interested in coming to the Birds of Prey program, please come to the end tent, and we will be starting the program within a few minutes.
Thank you very much.
The brushy-tailed ringtail possum has the heartbreaking distinction of being the first mammal species to become extinct because of global warming, climate change, erratic weather patterns, the increase of the Earth's temperature, its high fever. Is our hunger for fossil fuels, for having more, our binge on the planet insatiable? I'm thinking about our relationship to the planet, our willingness to make sacrifices, to advocate for it, which really is us, our place within the universe, as we multiply and organize, as we war and as we create, as the glaciers melt while the polar bears die, and as our mistakes and loving accumulate, can we increase our commitment to a worldwide environmental movement?
Darren McCosco. I cut logs for a living.
I just think 50 years ago, 60 years ago, it was a lot different than it is now. And I think global warming is happening just because it don't snow as much as it used to. And just you can tell the weather's a lot different. It just ain't how it's supposed to be. I'm 23, my dad's 63, and he just tells me how the winters used to be and how we used to get so much snow, and now we don't get no snow, and the summers aren't even hot no more. They're just more humid. It's just moisture in the air from, I guess, the glaciers melting. I'd hate to see the world change like that. I mean, if the climate's changing, the trees are going to grow different, and just everything's going to start changing.
Hi, my name is Joan. I think that it is many problems sort of wrapped up in one, and I think it stems from overpopulation. And I think if the human race got their overpopulation under control, a lot of the other things would be able to get under control as well.
The quality of our lives here on this planet are directly connected to the quality of the environment. And that's something that we need to maintain and to do the best we can to enhance it. And there are so many obvious examples of that. One of the most clearly one globally is the increase of the temperature around the planet and the likelihood of continued global warming. Mm-hmm. It isn't absolutely definite, but all of the evidence so far indicates that this planet is warming up. A good part of that has to do with the emissions that come up from carbon and the production of fossil fuels and the burning of all of those materials, coal and a whole host of things. These are things that we have to deal with. And we have to also deal with things that have been dealt with here in this region for a long, long time, like
yes.
protecting the open environment, protecting mm-hmm. the natural system, protecting the woods, the trees, the natural resources here in the Catskill Mountains. Catskill Mountains are a great example of the kinds of things that are so wonderful and beautiful. As I travel across the district that I represent, I travel across the Catskill Mountains frequently. It's just a marvelous experience. It's a beautiful, beautiful place, and it's something that we need to protect and enhance, make stronger and more beneficial as time goes on. It's a matter of responsibility to continue to protect this land and mm-hmm. to enhance it, make it stronger, make it more effective, make it more livable, and make the contents of it more safe and secure for our generation and for an indefinite number of future generations.
Thank you so much, Congressman Maurice Cinci.
Thank you.
I'm Carolyn. I worry about it all the time. I really do. One thing that I think about when you use the term climate change is that I hate that term. It's so neutral. I think there's, without a doubt, the fact that what we're experiencing now is man-made, and change sounds like it could be simply and only a natural process. And I don't think that's true. I don't think anyone thinks that anymore or can sustain that belief for very long. So I'm trying to think of an alternative term, climate catastrophe, catastrophic climate change, climate crisis, weather meltdown. All of those things seem better. Global warming, too, I think it sounds pleasant, and I don't think the results are going to be very pleasant, or even now they are not.
My name is Midge Maroney. I live in Chandelier and in Manhattan.
Climate change?
Climate change. There's no such thing. Yeah, right. I think this summer and last winter is an absolute indication. I mean, you can look at weather patterns, and you see that the Canadian cold air that we never had before that has just stayed there this summer. I'm not a scientist. I teach English. But it's obvious the pattern is there. It's too much change worldwide. It's definitely global change, climate change, weather change. The polar bear is sitting on an ice cube as we speak. So
the land with its majesty, its open wild spaces, and its mysterious and necessary diversity is more valuable than piles of gold. These mountains and the river valleys with their beauty nourishes us so generously is at present being compromised by the trading of land for leases in this Marcellus Shale region. This is the place that I call home, and where I listen to the singing of the trees and the songs of the water, where I hear the magical pulse of life and of the possibility of future. What happens if the energy companies buy it and we become swallowed by the deadly chemicals, by radioactive materials, and the polluted water that provides life for everything?
Who will want to live near this kind of an industry? I mean, you wouldn't want to be anywhere near one of these things. The traffic, the tanks, the dust, the noise, the lights. I'm Maria Grimaldi, and I live outside of Youngsville, New York. I guess I'm an avid environmentalist. I have a small organic farm. I am a member of the Catskill Mountain Keeper Association. I'm a former Cornell Cooperative Extension educator. I was on the board of directors of the Sullivan County Soil and Water Conservation District, and I'm very concerned about these issues that are coming for us. Very concerned.
And Maria, what are your concerns?
So many people have worked so hard to take care of our beautiful environment up here, our water resources, our farmland, the trees, the animals, the peace and the quiet, and to allow an industry that is so polluting as this hydrofracking operation of going for natural gas to come into the Catskill Park, the National Park area along the Delaware River and in the Catskill Forest is, to me, totally outrageous. I just don't understand what are they thinking. It's just outrageous to allow an industry to come in to help make money for a handful of people and put all of our natural resources in jeopardy. This is not something that's going to invite tourists and second homeowners to come here and invest in good properties. Who is going to benefit from this operation? A handful of landowners who, for whatever reasons, whether they are financially strapped or whether they're just greedy, or these big companies such as Halliburton, do we need to go there again? I mean, who are the real terrorists here coming into an area that is so peaceful and so beautiful and, all right, maybe a little impoverished right now?
I'm Laura Moran. None of this can be. I mean, plants, and people need some very basic things in order to live and survive. And a couple of the things that we share, and most significantly what we share with the plants, vegetables, flowers, everything around us, is water. And it's a precious resource. Starting now, we've really got to concentrate on what's going to happen and focus what's going to happen to our water source here in Sullivan County, which reaches the Delaware, where it's all starting up by the East Branch, and from Binghamton on down to Philadelphia. I mean, that's our Delaware River. That's so important. And there are so many streams and tributaries that lead into that, where historically the farms have used those streams and tributaries and the flooding fields as growing fields. If there's stuff in the water that's getting into the fields, that's a problem. If there's no water, that's also a problem. There's only so much out there. But what surprised me, living now by the river, is how the river changes, how alive the river is. And it's never a static entity. It's so alive, and you really have to engage it almost every day when you live near it. And I think that the people who are coming in just to use it as an industrial resource don't understand that vitality of the river and how it is such a changeable, its own creature, its own character here among us. I mean, these are river towns. These are towns that grew up on the rivers for reasons.
You know, our values have to change. Are we only alive for a short period of time so we can accumulate wealth? It just sounds so sick to do that, to be that way. Don't have an answer for anything, but I definitely think that people should reassess their whole life, find out what's important. My name is Suzanne Bevier. It's a really good chocolate
brownie.
Good. I made them today. They're fresh.
What happens if we end up hating each other because protections are not put in place? What happens if we want to run but we have nowhere to go? What happens if instead of songs of beauty and the natural landscape, we hear the cries in the night of cracking and poisoned water tables? Without water, we will be pulling the trigger guaranteeing our demise. So as I lift this pure sweet glass of Catskill water to my lips, I ask for the courage to find a better way to move through this life, and I demand that this land is protected so that we all can continue to have a home.
Good morning,
dear. Good to see you.
Hello, but I brought you a hat.
Oh!
And I only brought one for whoever else was in the trailer.
So John Adams has given me an NRDC, Natural Resources Defense Council hat, which I appreciate and certainly could use on a day like this when there's a bit of rain in the air. John Adams, first of all, it's a pleasure.
Well,
to...
A lot of fun to be with you.
Thank you very much. You have been called many things.
I'm sure.
All kinds. Of course, your job can be very confrontational and difficult. But what I hear and read and what people speak about with you is what an incredible advocate you have been for the earth. And, you know, you are the litigator for so many crucial issues for us here with the earth. And you are the guardian through your organization. And in addition to the NRDC, you're also very involved with the Open Space Institute and some other projects. What I am so curious about is, what is your connection here to this region, to the county, to the rivers behind us? And then from there, bring that into your connection to environmental issues.
Well, thanks for your very nice words.
You're welcome.
My connection is very simple. If you look past the bridge to a white house on the hillside, that's where I spent my teenage years. And until I left home and was married and moved to the Beaverkill, I lived with my parents in that little white house about 300 yards from Junction Pool. So the river and the Junction Pool are very close to my upbringing and my life. And so it's a pretty simple thing. I fished there and particularly swam there and took my friends there and got to know the river extremely well, and now live about 7 miles up the river in the Upper Beaverkill.
So you live on the Beaverkill River, one of the most famous fly fishing rivers in the country. And this connection that you speak of in your childhood of playing there and joining your friends and spending time in the river, did that lead you and connect you to form the NRDC and to really become such an advocate for the environment?
Well, it certainly played a part. You know, there are a lot of things in your life. You have parents, and I spent my preteen years on a farm not far from here. And so I really had an opportunity to get to know land and forests and rivers and streams and spend a lot of time alone in getting to know those wonderful environmental attributes.
You were instrumental in the writing of the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act, just following the formation of the NRDC.
Well, as I say, we were very fortunate to be at the beginning of something. And when we started NRDC, there was no Clean Air Act and no Clean Water Act and no Coastal Zone Management Act or Endangered Species Act or Wilderness Act. So to be there at the beginning and have enough money to hire good lawyers and the people who care deeply about these issues, we were able to be a participant in the writing of all of those statutes and then the enforcement of those statutes. So yes, it was a very exciting time, and the fact that there's a worldwide environmental movement that didn't exist in 1969 or 70 has to also give you a lot of encouragement. But yes, we're faced with a very significant challenge to what this planet we live on will be like if we don't gain control over what we're doing to it.
John Adams, thank you for taking the time this morning.
It's a pleasure, and thank you for having me.
From the kitchen table out on the road, I'm Sabrina Artel.
Donations to support Trailer Talk are always gratefully received. You can find a link to make your tax-deductible donation at trailertalk.net.
Thanks for joining me for Sabrina Artel's Trailer Talk. The music for the show, Patti Smith, People Have the Power. Trailer Talk is produced by Sabrina Artel. For more information, please visit trailertalk.net. Special thanks to WJFF Radio Catskill and the numerous people who have donated their time, resources, and conversations to make Trailer Talk possible. Thank you all who joined me in these conversations. I'm Sabrina Artel. Safe travels.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Tavern on Main, where modern American cuisine meets classic favorites. Dinner, weekend brunch, craft cocktails, and warm hospitality on Main Street in Jeffersonville. More at tavernonmainny.com.
I'm Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, there are 18,000 known diseases, and only about a quarter of them have an FDA-approved treatment. But for some of them, there is a cure hiding in plain sight.
I just haven't been able to stop thinking about how many more drugs are out there that could treat patients in need.
How to repurpose existing drugs into new treatments. That's next time on Freakonomics Radio. Tuesday afternoon at 2 on Radio Catskill.
On the next Radiolab.
Category 4, it hit there in nearly a century.
It's massive.
What if the secret to predicting hurricanes?
150 mile per hour winds ripped apart buildings.
Lies in trees.
Really gnarly pine trees.
Let's start talking about his tree rings.
And piracy.
I be Blackbeard.
That's on the next Radiolab. Wednesday afternoon at 2 on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, this is Radio Catskill.
local news, culture, and NPR.